From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. In 1998, Big Tobacco paid $250 billion to settle the largest civil lawsuit in U.S. history. On this week's podcast, we ask, what happened to that money?
So many hundreds of millions of dollars have gone to states, and the states have made choices not to spend it on public health or tobacco prevention, which is what we fought these lawsuits about.
Then an American doctor shares his story of kidnap in Afghanistan.
And then the last demand was, during this time, if you don't follow our commands and our requests, we will kill you.
Also, the untold story of Islam and the Founding Fathers.
Islam was an American religion that had been in the United States really since the 17th century, as long as Protestantism.
And America's best-loved composer, Philip Glass, is surprised at the popularity of Einstein on the Beach.
One of the reasons that people like it so much today is that they haven't seen it.
When it comes to animal espionage, ravens are the master spies. Pigeons, not so much.
Sometimes pigeons would just sort of fly away and they wouldn't come back, or you weren't quite sure if they had been shot down.
Plus a studio visit from Jack Black and Kyle Gass, the one and only Tenacious D.
All Things Considered, ATC, coming right out of Culver City. This song is a very pretty come on.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West.
You give the news tonight. You give it fresh and real.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth.
So number one, I would like to start with, if you open up your folder, with Just the Facts. Just the Facts talks about how many chemicals are inside a cigarette.
In the basement of Anaheim Regional Medical Center, Luisa Santa is teaching the first of a five-part class for people who want to quit smoking.
So go ahead and take a minute or two to write down maybe one or two reasons why you want to quit, and we'll talk about them in just a bit.
This class is free for anyone living or working in Orange County, California. When they sign up, participants get a quit kit full of things like toothpicks and gum. And if they come for at least three of the five sessions, they get a free two-week supply of nicotine patches.
Okay, guys, so let's go ahead and talk about one or two reasons why you're here, why you're considering quitting smoking. Let's go ahead and start with Susan.
It's my health, and it's embarrassing. I feel ashamed. I feel like I have to hide my hand with the cigarette in it from people because I don't want them to know I'm a smoker.
Hmm. What about you, Joanne?
Well, for me, I'm worried if I don't stop smoking now that I might get sick later.
Every year since 1998, this program has been funded by some of the more than $100 billion tobacco companies have paid to state governments as part of a 25-year $246 billion settlement plan. Here in Orange County, voters have mandated that 80% of the county's money from tobacco companies is spent on smoking-related programs, like this class.
Any questions, ladies? Okay. Thank you so much.
But Orange County is an outlier. 15 years after what is still the largest civil litigation settlement in U.S. history, it's unclear how most state and local governments are using their share of the tobacco money. And that's our cover story. In the mid-1990s, Mississippi was the undisputed leader on the tobacco issue. In 1994, Mike Moore, the state attorney general, filed the first state lawsuit against Big Tobacco. Individual lawsuits by smokers had failed because courts held people responsible for their decision to smoke. But Moore argued the state shouldn't be forced to pay the cost of treating smoking-related illnesses. Here he is speaking to NPR in 1994.
Things such as lung cancer, heart disease, emphysema, low birth weight babies, and others, we have to pay. The state's obligated to pay for those for our citizens that are not covered in other ways, and we feel like they're caused by the tobacco products, and we think the tobacco companies should pay their fair share.
Tobacco companies should pay for medical bills, he argued, and eventually the courts agreed. The settlement also meant the end of cigarette ads and targeting youth. Remember Joe Camel and the Marlboro Man? If not, it's because they were killed off in the 90s. The settlement left the tobacco companies immune from future state and federal lawsuits. Looking back today, Mike Moore remembers a long slog.
It was not an easy task. some people that are spending the money these days from the settlement think the money just fell out of heaven. But, you know, when we filed our case here in 1994, you know, my governor actually sued me to try to stop the tobacco case. The tobacco companies sued me to try to stop the case, went all the way to my Supreme Court.
Moore is now on the board of the American Legacy Foundation. It was created by the tobacco settlement. The organization's mission is to create national anti-smoking campaigns, like the famous truth ads.
Big tobacco manipulated nicotine levels. But too much nicotine can make you sick.
That's why they need the magical amount. Too much nicotine might make you sick, not enough, you might quit and walk away.
The tobacco settlement included money specifically to fund PSAs like that one. But Moore says most of the settlement money came with no strings attached. The states could spend the tobacco money however they wanted, and it was impossible to hold them accountable. Colorado has spent tens of millions of its share to support a literacy program. Kentucky spent half of its money in agricultural programs. In Mississippi, says Moore, a lot of the settlement money was spent on things other than smoking prevention and health care.
The state put all the money in a trust fund. But what happened as the years go by is that legislators come and go, as you know, and governors come and go. We got a new governor, and he had a different opinion about the tobacco trust fund, and some new legislators, and they had some different opinions. So a trust fund that ought to have $2.5 billion in it now doesn't have much at all. And it's not just Mississippi, but all across the country. So many hundreds of millions of dollars have gone to states, and the states have made choices not to spend it on public health or tobacco prevention, which is what we fought these lawsuits about. And that's my biggest disappointment.
And how does this sort of boil down to for an individual smoker in Mississippi? You know, how are things different for him or her in terms of quitting, getting health care than they were all those years ago?
Things are good, actually, from that standpoint. We spent a lot of money on tobacco prevention programs in the early years. I continued to be Attorney General until 2004, and until that time, we had a very robust prevention program that reduced teen smoking by over 50% in just 5 years, its first 5 years, and we actually reduced adult smoking by about 25%, which was a remarkable thing. Those things have slowly drifted back the other way, but you know, teen smoking still down about 50%, which is amazing. And it's that way most of the country, too. We need to continue the vigilance. We got new products coming out, e-cigarettes and the like. So we got the money to do something about the problem. We just need to talk the states back into spending some money to do something about it.
Mike Moore, former Attorney General of Mississippi. Myron Levin covered the tobacco industry for the Los Angeles Times for many years. He says talking states into spending settlement money on tobacco prevention is tough.
There was the feeling that there was definitely a moral obligation to spend at least a sizable chunk of money on programs to help people quit smoking and to prevent kids from starting, you know, to show this was not just a big money grab. So it was understood without being codified into the agreement that states would make a big investment in this. And in fact, they haven't.
To help guide state governments, in 2007, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommended that states reinvest 14% of the money from the settlement and tobacco taxes into anti-smoking programs. Again, Myron Levin.
What the states have actually done in the last 15 years has fluctuated somewhat year by year according to financial cycles and political ones, but it's never come close to 14%. There are some fairly notorious cases of money being used for fixing potholes, for tax relief, for financial assistance to tobacco farmers. There are states that don't have any money coming in anymore because they securitized their future payments, sold them off to investors, and got a big lump sum covering a portion of what they were to receive and just dumped it into general fund.
Myron, I remember back at the time of the settlement, and again, it was such a huge amount of money, people were saying, oh, this is going to kill the tobacco companies. There's going to be no more R.J. Reynolds or Philip Morris. These guys are they're done.
No. When you are supplying the most widely used addictive product in the world, you have certain advantages. And they have done a terrific job of covering their bases by moving into products such as smokeless and now electronic cigarettes, which not only provide the opportunity for big sales in the future, but may neutralize in some respects the effect of all the public smoking bans that exist, because if in fact you can sustain your nicotine dependence during the day without offending people or being thrown out of the building by smokeless tobacco or using electronic cigarettes, you're less likely to maybe to be able to quit. So for all these reasons, I mean, I think they really landed on their feet.
And in terms of marketing, one of the other parts of the settlement involved tobacco advertising. How have things changed and how the tobacco companies adapted?
Well, that has changed a lot. The settlement took out billboard ads. It took out some conventional forms of advertising. Really, most of their so-called advertising dollar went into unconventional forms, and that's kind of saturating the retail environment, the counter of the store, and buying shelf space in supermarkets. So if you go in to a major grocery store and you look at the array of cigarettes, it's no accident that, for instance, all the Philip Morris brands are on the top at eye level, or all the Reynolds brands are on top because they paid for that. So a lot of what is called cigarette advertising is not the old style cigarette advertising.
So how would you track this as a just looking in terms of how between the taxes and the other disincentives for smoking, has it been generally successful, do you think?
I think it depends on your definition of success. I think that there are fewer cigarettes being sold and smoked today than there would have been if none of this had happened. You're certainly down now to where a lot of the people probably that can be reached with an anti-smoking message have been reached, and you get down to a harder core of people who probably aren't going to quit because they're young and they want to take chances. They don't think they're ever going to die. There is a disproportionate number of smokers who have mental illness. One other effect that I think the settlement had kind of indirectly, long after the settlement was reached, legislation was introduced to give the FDA authority over tobacco products. They got that in 2009 in a bill that Obama signed. Something that could happen is they could ratchet down the allowable levels of nicotine in cigarettes to a level that is essentially non-addictive. That would be a total game changer.
Myron Levin is the founder of the health and safety news site Fair Warning. Non-addictive cigarettes would be a game changer for people like Susan Halleck back in Orange County. She desperately wants to quit.
I feel ashamed. I feel like I have to hide my hand with the cigarette in it.
But the nicotine keeps her coming back over and over.
I'll smoke about a few, like 6 to 8 months, and then I'll quit. Or I'll smoke a month and quit. It's just different every time.
She's hoping this time, with this free class, she'll be successful. And she has a real chance. This program has a 50% quit rate for adults like Susan. The United States has been fighting the war in Afghanistan for more than 12 years now. And few Americans have come to know the country the way this man has.
My name is Dilip Joseph, and I'm a medical doctor that works with an organization called Morningstar Development. And the place where we work is Afghanistan.
Dr. Joseph has been to Afghanistan 10 times in the last 4.5 years. And his work has taken him to clinics and community centers in the war zone, where he trains local healthcare workers.
The motto is to work yourself out of a job, equip others, train others in areas where you've gotten training.
Joseph says he has always been aware of security concerns. After all, this is Afghanistan. But this last trip, his 10th, was different. On December 5th, 2012, Dilip Joseph came face-to-face with the Taliban. That's our cover story today. One man's account of kidnapping, captivity, and ultimately, rescue.
On this particular occasion, we were traveling from Kabul to one of our most rural community centers.
Joseph does not speak the local language, Pashto, and so he traveled with two Afghan colleagues from his organization. After finishing their work that day, they went to a local police chief's house for lunch.
There was some conversation going on about security measures in the area, and I didn't think much of it. I think in retrospect, I was thinking maybe he was picking up certain things that I certainly wasn't aware of.
Dr. Joseph and his two Afghan colleagues started driving back to Kabul. As they came down a winding mountain road, a man with a gun suddenly popped out.
I didn't see him initially, but the driver did, and he put the brakes on very quickly. As soon as this guy kind of fired a warning shot, We saw more people from the front and the back sort of cover us. I think there were about four of them with guns that covered us right away. You know, being an ethnic Indian, I look not very different from them. So they actually certainly didn't know who the foreigner was. So I don't think they picked up on the fact until we were put back in our vehicle and taken to a very remote area. At that point, they looked a bit more closely through my belongings in my backpack. And unfortunately, I had my American passport in my bag, and then they figured out I was an American.
Which I imagine changed things dramatically.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, they knew right away just from looking at the passport that they could raise the stakes, so to speak.
So once they had determined your American citizenship, what happened from that point?
We got to this remote valley. Our hands were tied, and so we started hiking, which was very difficult. That hiking itself took about nine and a half hours. So when we did sit down for the very first time, I did try to connect with them and saying, you know, I'm originally from your part of the world, and I come here to treat your brothers and sisters and your mothers and fathers. I wanted that to be a two-way conversation, but it was very much a monologue.
How much at this point are you in fear for your life?
Oh, very much so. I mean, that idea of perhaps my life is in danger is certainly in the forefront of my thinking. So I went through a very interesting and very relieving exercise of just kind of coming to the consensus that I could be killed, and thought through all the different ways. I've already had a very blessed life and counted all the different ways that I've been able to live a good life so far. So I did certainly go through that, you know, mental exercise of realizing, yeah, this could be a dire situation for me.
It's just kind of remarkable to me, though, that you make the most of those several hours you have walking to make peace with yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I figured it's either that or not being at peace, and I didn't want to be, the way I look at it, be pissed off right before getting killed.
As the sun went down, the group hiked by moonlight to a remote shack. There, the three kidnappers made their demands.
They needed us to provide around $300,000. Then the other demand was, within 2 to 3 days, this needs to be settled. If not, the Pakistan Taliban will come and take you to Pakistan. And then the last demand was, during this time, if you don't follow our commands and our requests, we will kill you.
Joseph was allowed to call his office in Kabul to report the kidnapping and to relay the demands. But as the second day wore on, the group lost cell phone service. And through the translator, Joseph's three captors began to talk with him.
They had a lot of questions about, you know, what my life was like, you know, what my family was like, and why I do what I do. And, you know, going through that, opening up my own life, really enabled this one young man who was 19 years old to open up about his own life. He was sort of almost comparing his life to mine. And in that conversation, I obviously figured out that he was 19 years old, and I stopped him right there and said, you know, I'm 39 and I'm old enough to be your father. And then he opened up about his father being in prison for the past 14 years. So essentially, he had only seen his father for 5 years, and in those 5 years, all he had seen his father do was insurgency activities. And so he made this conclusion of, well, your parents taught you something else than what my parents taught me, and that's why you do what you do. And the reason why I do things that I do is because I haven't been taught anything else.
Dr. Joseph says the negotiations for his release eventually broke down. By the fourth day of his captivity, the kidnappers decided to split the group up.
When my colleagues left, I pretty much figured that this is the last time we were going to see each other. So I hugged them goodbye and teared up as I was doing that. And three of these five men came up and wiped my tears. Of course, some of them, a couple of them, didn't even bother connecting with me either through gestures. If anything, they would make rude gestures about how they were going to kill me and how they're happy about this whole captivity.
Then came the fourth night. At that point, Dr. Joseph was being held in a small room. It was pitch black.
I heard something happening outside in terms of dogs barking and the sheep making noise. And my nose had started running at that time, so I was totally awake. And that's when I sort of heard this very loud firing of the gun, and I figured that that was from my insurgents.
Joseph says Taliban gunfire hit the first man to come through the door. It was a Navy SEAL and a member of the elite SEAL Team 6. This was a rescue operation. The other members of the SEAL team called out to Joseph, and he called back.
As soon as the SEALs recognized where my voice was coming from, one of them just came and laid on top of me, and others must have taken out most of these guys, except for the 19-year-old. So as I walked out, I saw this 19-year-old just lock eyes with me. And then when I was brought back into the room, because the helicopter was going to take a few more minutes to come, I did see that he was also killed.
In a few short moments, it was all over. The Navy SEAL who had been shot, Petty Officer First Class Nicholas Check, was dead. He was 28 years old. A helicopter arrived and brought Joseph to a military base. His Afghan colleagues also made it to safety. A few days after the rescue, Joseph returned home to his family in Colorado. In a statement, they said, "We could not be more grateful for that soldier's heroism and for the bravery of all involved in the mission to bring Dilip home." Since then, Joseph has had time to sort out the complicated emotions of his captivity.
This whole experience for me, what it made me realize is this simple and yet maybe a complex situation that even the Taliban can be reached. Because at the end of the day, they realize that this is a dead end, what they're doing. And they're also having the simple desires that you and I have for a better future, better education for their kids, and what have you. So this experience does give me actually, and as ironic as this sounds, gives me more hope than I actually had even before.
That's Dr. Dilip Joseph. Last year, he was kidnapped in Afghanistan and held captive for 5 days. Despite that experience, he says he would like to return for what would be his 11th trip to Afghanistan. Thomas Jefferson had a vast personal library reflecting his enormous curiosity about the world. Among his volumes, a Quran, which informed his foundational ideas about plurality in America. Joining me is Denise Spellberg, Associate Professor of History and Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Texas, and author of the new book, Thomas Jefferson's Quran. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Arun. Glad to be here.
So how did Jefferson come to have a copy of the Quran? Was it hard to come across back at that time?
Well, he actually was a bibliophile from the beginning, and he ordered this Quran in 1765, 11 years before he wrote the Declaration of Independence. He was a law student at the time, and he had the book shipped from England to Williamsburg, Virginia.
And it's something that's actually really interesting to see. You can actually see on the Library of Congress website, you can see Jefferson's copy of the Quran.
Yeah, absolutely. His two-volume copy that he bought for 16 shillings. There's an entry in the local newspaper because they were the booksellers for the time. So that's how we know the year. In fact, he bought it in October of 1765.
So can you talk about how did Muslim philosophy fit or clash with the dominant ideals that were percolating that informed the founding of America?
Well, you know, Europeans and Americans after them in this period tended to be quite hostile toward Islam. And yet, Jefferson was curious about the religion and law of Muslims. And that's probably why he bought the Quran.
Now, one of the things that you write about is that we, more of a sort of internal thoughts about Islam are a mystery, but we do know about how he thought about Islam in terms of a pluralistic society. And he clashed with John Adams about that, yes?
Yes. I mean, Jefferson was unique in many ways. He criticized Islam, as he did Christianity and Judaism. He talked about Islam as a religion that repressed scientific inquiry, a strange idea he got from Voltaire that wasn't right. But Jefferson, unlike Adams, was able to separate his principles about Muslim religious liberty and civil rights from these inherited European prejudices about Islam. He did the same thing when arguing for the inclusion of Catholics and Jews, actually. He had not very good things to say about either Catholicism or Judaism, but he insisted that these individual practitioners should have equal civil rights.
And something that fascinated me is that there were people at the time making an argument, which we have been hearing a lot in the last 12 years, that Islam is just incompatible with democracy, that they can't work together.
Well, Jefferson never felt that way, and he never felt that way because he believed at the time and resisted the notion, for example, that Catholics were a threat to the United States because of their allegiance to the Pope as a foreign power. There were many Protestants who would have disagreed with him about Catholics and many who would have disagreed with him about Muslims. They were the outsiders whose inclusion represented the furthest reach of toleration and rights. So for Jefferson and others, and he was not alone in this, although it was a minority, for him to include Muslims meant to include everyone of every faith, Jews, Catholics, and all others, and to exclude Muslims meant that there would be no universal principle of civil rights for all believers in America.
So was this all theoretical, or was there any kind of Muslim population in America in the 1770s?
Jefferson and Washington and others were theorizing about a future American population when, ironically and tragically, they never knew that real Muslims were already in America, but they were slaves brought from West Africa against their will. We don't know how many were the first American Muslims. We think they numbered in the thousands or tens of thousands. And it's not impossible that Jefferson actually owned Muslim slaves from Africa, but there's no direct evidence of it. That's not the case for George Washington, his neighbor in Virginia. Washington, among his taxable items, someone on his plantation listed the names of Fatimer and Little Fatimer. And despite being spelled with an ER at the end, this is clearly the name of the prophet's daughter, Fatima. So there were Muslim women working on Washington's plantation at the same time he was inviting people of all faiths to a protected religious liberty and rights in the United States.
Can you see any echoes of the way that Jefferson wrestled with the Quran in our democracy today?
I think that there is anxiety about what Muslims believe, largely because people don't understand Islam very well. And I think that was also true in the 18th century. It strikes me that Jefferson was theorizing for a future that included Muslims, not in spite of their religion, but because of it, because of his notion of universal civil rights. With American Muslims today and numbering in the millions as citizens, and Islam the nation's fastest growing faith, I think it's time to challenge the wrong and historically inaccurate idea that Muslims are somehow not fully American. They have been for a long time. And I think that that's where Jefferson would be today in this debate about Islam and Muslim citizenship in this country.
Denise Spellberg's new book is Thomas Jefferson's Quran. Very interesting stuff, Denise. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Arun.
If you're just joining us, this is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Philip Glass has achieved a rare feat for an American composer. He's embraced by the musical establishment, and his music is heard far outside classical circles. Beck recently helped him produce a tribute album. But as Glass's most famous opera, Einstein on the Beach, hits the LA Opera this weekend, attended by the likes of Kim Kardashian and Kanye West, it's easy to forget just how far this music was from the mainstream when it premiered. After its Met debut in 1976, New York Times critic Clive Barnes wrote, "I have rarely heard a first-night audience respond so vociferously at the Metropolitan Opera House as for this bizarre, occasionally boring, yet always intermittently beautiful theater piece."
It's a story that you have to create for yourself. We don't give you a plot. We give you a theme, and the audience completes the story.
That's Philip Glass. The opera actually makes intense demands of its audience, 4.5 unbroken hours of music. The audience is invited to get up and take breaks as they need them. There's no plot, but the opera is about Einstein. Kind of. It's also about the existential uncertainties of the nuclear age, and about women's liberation, and space exploration, and a lot of other stuff. There are texts of nonsense syllables, solfège notes, and strings of numbers, spoken and sung. When you talk with Philip Glass about the opera's popularity, he's quick to point out that this current run is actually the first full production of the work since the 1990s.
There hasn't been one in 20 years. You couldn't even see an imitation of Einstein. No one did it. So that when we do it now, people are seeing it really as if it's for the first time. Because, in fact, for them, it is the first time.
The tragedy of that, Glass says, is that listening to the opera on record only gives you, maybe, half of the experience.
Well, they're missing most of the opera, actually. I mean, the only way you really get to know opera is you have to see the dances, you have to hear the speeches, you have to see the movement, you have to see the designs. Movement, text, image, and music, these are the four elements of theater, of opera. It's the earth, air, fire, and water. That's what it is.
One, two, three. I was in this prematurely air-conditioned supermarket, and there were all these aisles, and there were these bathing caps that you could buy that had these kind of 4th of July plumes on them. They were red and yellow and blue.
From the start, Einstein on the Beach was a collaboration between Glass and the visionary director and playwright Robert Wilson. I spoke with Wilson at the LA Opera this week.
First meeting, I asked him how he wrote music, and then he showed me in terms of math and numbers, and I said, oh, that's very similar to the way I construct a play. And we soon realized that we thought alike, and we decided from the very beginning that we would make it work together.
They agreed to work on a long, very long-form piece based on a historical character. Again, Philip Glass.
At one point, we had to find a name for the piece and what the piece would be about. We ended up with Einstein. That was the third idea.
What were the first two ideas?
I think he suggested Hitler. And I didn't like that so much. So I said, what about Gandhi? That was kind of the opposite. And I think he didn't respond to any what a theatrical idea about Gandhi would be. And then he said, what about Einstein? Well, Einstein had been a great hero of mine since I had been a child. So I immediately said, that's great. That's the idea.
Wilson began drawing. And Glass composed to the drawings, setting them out on his piano when he wrote his score. Wilson's vision was as far as you could get from the mainstream. He explained that when he first arrived in New York from Texas, he was actually repulsed by Broadway musicals.
Well, first of all, they were quite grotesque visually, and I was much more interested in going to a museum and looking at painting than to see this trash on Broadway. And the same with the Metropolitan Opera. It was, you know, the makeup, the costumes, the gestures, the way they behaved on stage, the scenery. It was grotesque.
But seeing the work of George Balanchine and the New York City Ballet triggered the opposite reaction in Wilson. Finally, someone was speaking his language.
What interests me was dance and the way that it was constructed with time-space constructions and that it was abstract. And so I always thought, why couldn't theater be that way, or an opera? So that's what we did.
For that essential dance element, Glass and Wilson turned to avant-garde dancer and choreographer Lucinda Childs. Like Glass and Wilson, she had a mathematical sensibility in her approach.
I had never worked with a composer before in this kind of traditional way. However, I felt that there was so much freedom in terms of thinking about the structure of the music that I didn't necessarily have to illustrate it. And I didn't have to ignore it. But I could find a dialogue in working with the music because of the mathematical structure, something that I can respond to. And it's similar to the way I work with my choreography.
Just as Einstein on the Beach challenges audiences, the performers do not have an easy ride. Musicians are required to act. The violinist Jennifer Koh is playing Einstein in this production. Some of the performers fly. During the dress rehearsal, the staging looked as complicated as a Cirque du Soleil show. Those challenges could explain, in part, why the influence of Einstein on the Beach on modern opera has been limited.
At the time, people said, oh, it's changed the world of opera. Actually, it never did. No one did The Son of Einstein or Waiting for Einstein. It never was imitated. One of the reasons that people like it so much today is that they haven't seen it.
And if the scene at the LA Opera last night was any indication, that may be about to change. Humans have used animals to help us wage war for over 2,000 years. Let slip the dogs of war was not just an expression. For hundreds of years, attack dogs were on the front lines of battle. The conquistadors' dogs used to terrify their enemies. We stopped using animals as warriors a long time ago, but not long ago, the CIA hoped to draft some into the Cold War. That's right, that bird on the park bench behind you could be a spy. Tom Vanderbilt wrote an article about animal CIA operatives for Smithsonian Magazine. Tom, welcome.
Great to be here.
So the piece is filled with these scenarios that sound almost too ridiculous to be true, but there was one then that was kind of my favorite. I know pigeons were used for communications in World War I. Can you talk about the plan to use pigeons to guide ballistic missiles?
Yes, this was a project that B.F. Skinner, the famous behavioral psychologist, he was working on a project with the armed services to basically install a set of pigeons inside the nose cone of a missile. And these pigeons were trained to basically peck at the image of a map because there would be a food reward. And this pecking would actually steer little motors in the missile and would deliver it to its target. There were a number of problems with the project, and it never actually took off. But this was pretty cutting-edge research in a way during World War II.
It sounds sort of like the tic-tac-toe playing chicken, and it turns out it's not too far removed from the tic-tac-toe playing chicken.
Yeah, there's a curious link here. There were a couple of graduate students working with Skinner at the time named Marion and Keller Breland. They called it applied animal psychology. How could you turn these techniques into commercial enterprises? So they opened a theme park in Little Rock called the IQ Zoo, which had all sorts of characters, the educated hen and Priscilla the fastidious pig. Priscilla the fastidious pig appeared in a number of television commercials doing things like vacuuming. So they were really training animals to do all sorts of things.
So this couple, they're training animals, and there was sort of a third wheel in their relationship. Can you tell us about Bob Bailey?
One day the Breelands were called out to China Lake, to the weapons research station out there, to do some research with the U.S. Navy's Dolphin program, training dolphins to do things like locate submarines or warn of enemy attack, things like that. And this was run by Bob Bailey, who was kind of an animal behaviorist of his own, and he was convinced to come work with the Breelands at the IQ Zoo.
So the CIA, they were trying to train animals, and they saw, these people could train a pig to vacuum. They must be able to do something. What were some of the animals that the CIA wanted to put to work?
There were a number of different programs that were tried. One was the so-called squab squad. It basically involved a flock of pigeons that would fly ahead of your troop formation. And if they detected the presence of an enemy battalion, they would all basically land. And this would be the signal, the giveaway, that there was enemy troops ahead. Fortunately, there were a few problems with that. I mean, sometimes pigeons would just sort of fly away and they wouldn't come back, or you weren't quite sure if they had been shot down. Another favorite program was called Acoustic Kitty. And this was a cat had an acoustic transmitter in its ear, another relay device implanted in its rib cage. And as the story goes, this cat was meant to, there was a Middle Eastern potentate who they were trying to get some intelligence on, and he was a real cat enthusiast. So the thought was if they could get a cat into his environment, it would sort of appear unnoticed. And the cat was trained to focus in on people's conversations, and it became sort of a bug.
Well, the conventional wisdom is that cats are untrainable, so Keller and Marion Breland, they'd conquered that?
Yes, I mean, Bob Bailey has told me that no animal is untrainable. I mean, certain animals are better than others. He, for example, thinks that pigeons aren't that clever. Owls are not very smart either, despite the stereotype of the wise owl. They may be wise, but they don't seem to be particularly smart. But ravens, in his mind, are the geniuses of the bird world. And kind of the Jason Bourne, they could be, sort of operate on their own. They were very, very intelligent. They could lift things. This is part of another program that they trained ravens to basically deposit things in rooms in particular places, and those things could be listening devices, for example.
You said that you were limited in how you could report on this, given how much of it was classified. So, is it possible, for all we know, that there are ravens still out there on the CIA payroll?
There could be. Maybe they're waiting to be activated, and they haven't come in from the cold, as it were. But, really one of the only documents that's ever been released has the wonderful title Views on Trained Cats, and most of it is actually blacked out, but it hints at how many problems there were in the program. So I think by and large this was just an interesting activity for the CIA that showed some promise under certain conditions, but just had too many sort of wild card variables that never was really quite as implemented as we might think. But because we don't really know, yes, it's possible there are still rogue ravens flittering around Eastern Europe, perhaps.
That's Tom Vanderbilt. He wrote an article about animal CIA operatives for this month's issue of Smithsonian Magazine. Tom, thanks.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Woodstock, of course, brought together some of the most important musical acts of the late 1960s, and it turned music festivals into historic events. These days, though, if you leave any pasture open long enough, some hipster will start setting up amps and concession stands. The outdoor music festival is everywhere. But so far, there's been no Woodstock of comedy. Well, two intrepid young organizers are trying to change all that. Their names, Kyle Gass and Jack Black. You might know them as... Tenacious D has organized an all-star comedy festival for next weekend at the Santa Monica Pier here in California. It's called Festival Supreme, and I'm proud to welcome Jack Black and Kyle Gass into the studio. Welcome.
Oh, my God. You've got thousands of people here. No, it's just Kyle. Thank you. That was a tremendous introduction.
Wow.
Thank you.
It's intense. The raw animal metal energy in this room. I don't know if NPR has ever experienced this
You could
before.
Cut it with a spoon.
I also appreciate you comparing our little festival to Woodstock. That is what we were going for.
Well, let's start. Is that a fair comparison, the Woodstock comparison?
Well, it's funny. We almost named our festival Wood Comedy.
No, we didn't. But it is fair in that it's the first of its kind, in our opinion. There hasn't been a real great comedy music festival that I know of ever. And not even a bad one. It doesn't forget, great one.
I think there's been some great musical comedy festivals.
Yeah, that's different. That's why we say comedy music.
Ah.
Not to be confused. There will be no, you know, Oklahoma songs that I know of.
Yeah.
Although we didn't tell any of the artists what to do. They may break into some musical theater.
And it's an insane lineup of some brilliantly funny people. I mean, I can't even read them all off, but Tim and Eric will be there, the Mr. Show Experience, Sarah Silverman, Zach Galifianakis. Adam Sandler he doesn't really perform much anymore, right?
No, but, you know, he's one of the forefathers of comedy music. He wrote some incredibly funny songs on Saturday Night Live, so we invited him, and we to our surprise, he was like, yeah, I'm game.
You don't need deck the halls or jingle bell rock, because you can spin a dreidel with Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock, both Jewish. Put on your yarmulke, it's time for...
Think we'll hear anything new from him?
He did say that he was going to be working up some new jams. We'll see. Our policy was just invite the geniuses and don't tell them what to do. Just tell them how long they have. But it's a four-stage event. There's going to be an open-air stage where all the rock bands and the big band things will happen. Like Maya Rudolph is going to be there with her band Princess, which is all Prince covers but done really hilarious.
Right. They do a great Darling Nikki.
You know.
What one brilliant person who sings that there's just one name that jumps out of this list I was amazed you're able to get.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Eric Idle.
Yeah.
We should say for people who were cave dwellers possibly, Eric Idle from Monty Python, responsible for some of the best songs.
That's right.
Spam-a-Lot.
That's right.
How did that happen?
That was a huge get. I sent him an email and just basically told him that he was my hero and that we loved him and that we were doing this thing, and I made it sound as attractive as possible. You know, there's going to be delicious foods. There's going to be, you know, the greatest comedians in the world there, and it wouldn't be complete without him, because he has definitely written some of the funniest songs in the history of comedy. And he responded with a positive. He was like, yeah, let's do this. I, to my shock.
For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bang.
The power of Jack's emails cannot be underestimated.
I do have a very seductive power with my emails. I can get anyone to do almost anything.
Maybe you can write an email for us. We can get President Obama on the show. We could use you. You could be a great booker, Jack Black. You're wasting it on rock and comedy.
You really want to get Barack? You want to get Barack Obama on the show? Has that been something you've been trying to
do
for
a long
time?
Can you do that for us?
I think I can get that done.
Yeah, Barry. He's an old pal.
But what you do, though, I mean, this is, like I said, this is an insane lineup.
It's a veritable who's who.
How much have you guys, I mean, is it you guys working the phones, or how did you pull it together?
I wasn't joking about the emails.
We emailed everyone, and basically the trick is you tell everyone, everyone else is already in. It's a dirty trick. And then they say, oh, well, if they're doing it, I want to do it too. I don't know if that's entirely kosher, but you do what you got to do.
So you're playing competitive comics off of each other and yeah.
Well, you're making it sound worse than it might be.
So this is a comedy and music festival, and I believe you gentlemen have your guitars with you.
What?
Yeah.
Do we happen to have our guitars?
Happen to.
You want a taste? But this is a song we're going to play for you now. It's kind of a departure from some of our other work. It's the ballad of Hollywood Jack and the Rage Cage. This is the ballad of Hollywood Jack and the Rage Cage. Nothing could stop him when Jables and Rage hit the stage. Then Hollywood Jack hit the big time and went to make movies. Rage Cage was left far behind in the dust of his dreams. And he grumbled and growled and watched Hollywood Jack on Jay Leno. He bellowed and said he'd be nothing without help from Cage. He burnt up the photos of Jables and Cage from the old days. Forget him, I don't need no Hollywood Jack anyway. So Hollywood Jack lived up high on a hill in a bubble. Rage Cage lived deep in the broiling valley below. Yes, the Rage Cage bubbled with rage. He looked at the ground and he looked on the stage. The lava was bubbling and broiling inside the old cage. And Hollywood Jack climbed the ladder of stardom before him. He watched as his indie credentials flew right out the door. He'd make millions and then he'd go out and he'd make even more millions. He'd screen Cage's calls and he'd party with Zsa Zsa Gabor. No one respected him, they just rejected him. No one would represent Cage. Lost on the streets of his dreams, he would cry and he'd rage for the stage.
That's Jack Black and Kyle Gass. They are Tenacious D, and they've organized an all-star comedy festival for next weekend in Santa Monica, California. It's called Festival Supreme. You can hear the full version of this performance without me talking over Kyle's lovely recorder solo at nprmusic.org. For the week ending October 13th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, and Jody Becker. Our intern is Francesca Fenzi. The technical director is Patrick Murray. Muthoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on Saturday and Sunday. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.
He grabbed their lapels and he screamed, by God, you must save him. Because of Rage Cage and I, can't you see that we're one and the same? Oh, Rage Cage, oh, the Rage Cage, oh, the magic inside that old name. And you know what you know when you're going completely insane. Ah, the Rage Cage, oh, the Rage Cage, oh, the lion will roar once again. And you know, yes, you know when you're going completely insane. Again. Nothing and no one could harm me.
shack and the rage cage would ride once again.